Good evening. It is just a little after 6 p.m., 6:01 p.m. to be exact, here on WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM. That the song you just heard was I'm Afraid of Americans by the one and only David Bowie from his album Earthling. This is the program where we're at. My name is Ben. I am live in the studio. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champagne, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. By the way, I'm one of those associates, the chair of the associates board, which... By the way, if you would like to become a member of WEFT, you can go to our website. I believe there is are we taking applications? I believe we are, or maybe we're not, but usually our membership meetings are once every three, I think our last one was in March, so we should be having one coming up. But if you would like to become a member of WEFT, I believe you can go on. There should be an application or instructions on that on our website at wEFT.org. By the way, we do have our app, the WEFT app. I believe if you go to, and in fact, I'm going to try to do it on my phone. If you go to the Google Play Store and you go to type in WEFT, you just type in WEFT FM, it should come up, and then I believe it's the same thing with the Android or Apple and Google Play Store. So Apple and Google Play Store, depending on whichever one you use, you can go on there, you can look at all of our shows and leave feedback, but we are very excited because we know as everyone consumes and listens to their radio and shows in any way, whether it's on a computer, in your car, on the radio in your car, obviously now we are trying to catch up now with our WEFT FM app. Part of the public media apps, which you can also leave feedback. I believe there is a feedback option that you could do in the app. So please use that if you would like. And since we are a publicly volunteer run radio station, we do rely on your donations. So if you can, if possible, and if you would like, you can go to our website, WEFT.org, and use our online donation form. You can click the blue Donate Now button to make, either a one-time or perhaps you want to make it a recurring donation. Yeah, you just click on the blue Donate Now button. All year long, WFT guides you on a journey through independent music and public affairs programming. The volunteer, as we say, the volunteer hosts, the curate, and select WFT's programs are community members, your friends and neighbors, and we all thank you. Thank you for our listeners for your continuous support. I believe we've been going, WFT has been going since 1981. I believe, and we're very grateful for all of our supporters and listeners out there. We got some house cleaning, as I like to say, or public service announcements. I don't see a calendar for the Rose Bowl Tavern on here. I think we need to get our June calendar here, but if you go to Rose Bowl Tavern, there's usually number of events going on there, down there in Urbana. Let me just pull up. Looks like there's improvisation exchange. There's, as usual, there's the Urbana Hootenanny trivia. And as usual on Wednesday nights, there's trivia night. Larry Gray guitar accordion trio on Wednesday, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Then there, as I said, trivia night from 7:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then there's jazz jam from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. And on Thursday, there's Americana happy hour, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And 8 p.m., Nectar, Moon Type, Liz Allen. I'm not sure what kind of music that is. On Saturday, Planned Parenthood presents Music in Action 2.0, presented by the Muhammad Persistent Hood and hosted by the Rose Bowl Tavern. They ask to join to supporting Planned Parenthood of Illinois. Every contribution helps, and all proceeds will be donated. They suggest a donation of $20 at entry point. That's from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. on June 7th. Let's see. Oh, and as I said, other house cleaning or public service announcements that we have, this is a usual one. Do you have an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you would like to get rid of? You can donate any old vehicle to charitable adult rides and services and designate WFT to receive the proceeds from your gift. All you need is a clear title. Charitable adult rides and services will pick it up and haul away with no charge to you. Make arrangements on the website at careasy.com. Or you can call 855-500-RIDE. That's 855-500-7433. Remember to tell them that you want WFT to receive the proceeds. Did have one... thing. This is a news release from about the Champaign Regional Planning Commission summer cooling program, which is set to help Champaign County households at greater risk from extreme heat, which I'm sure we'll see those. Today was a pretty hot day. It was up in the 80s, but I'm sure we'll see it get up in the 90s and possibly even higher. This is about the summer cooling program, which will begin on June 9th and is expected to help as many as 200 households from the Champaign Regional Planning Commission, due in large part to the historical high demand for utility assistance and the fact that supplemental resources allocated for utility assistance during the COVID pandemic have not been sustained post-pandemic by the federal government. The Regional Planning Commission exhausted its funds for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, known as LIHEAP, in early May. With summer 2025 once again forecasted to be especially warm, the Regional Planning Commission is addressing the gap in service by administering a summer cooling program to support low-income households in Champaign County at the greater risk from extreme heat. The summer cooling program is made possible with funding from the Community Services Block Grant, CSBG. The program is anticipated to allow the RPC to help 200 to 350 households to maintain power in their homes during the summer, with the amount of bill assistance per household not to exceed $1,000. Eligibility criteria for the summer cooling program includes the following. They must be Champaign County residents. The household's most recent 30-day income must be at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. The household must include a seniors age 60 and above, or an individual with a medical certificate documenting a condition that requires active power in the household. And lastly, the household's power services is disconnected or immediate disconnect status. Champaign County households interested in applying for the summer cooling program could start doing so on June 9th. So that would be a week from today. June 9th, appointments will be available on a walk-in, first-come, first-served basis only from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, and on Wednesdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Appointments will be available at the Regional Planning Commission's office inside the Brookings Administrative Center, located at 1776 East Washington Street in Urbana, and at 2009 Round Barn Road in Champaign at the Rantoul Business Center, located at 601 South Century Boulevard, Suite 1314. And then there's LIHEAP will also resume taking new applications on October 1st of this year, in 2025. For households with anyone age 60 or older, same criteria, person with documented disability, families with children under age 6, and disconnect notice households. But all this information is available about summer cooling program can be found at the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission website, which is ccrpc.org. Again, all this information about summer cooling program and all these other programs, such as LIHEAP, homeless prevention, rent assistance, homeless services, developmental disabilities services, HUD, senior services, transportation assistance, all these other programs that are you could find about information about criteria for at the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission website, which is ccrpc.org. Well, that's essentially all I wanted to tell to you all live in the studio. I'm going to play a pre-recorded news program. I believe this is Breakthrough News Radio. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of a speaker and don't necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And now, this is Breakthrough News Radio.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. Today, we're going to discuss why Israel fears a U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, an anti-genocide pledge for Palestine, the reality of Donald Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, and we speak with a television star who refuses to stay silent on Gaza. But first, some headlines. On Friday, the Supreme Court ruled that the Donald Trump White House can temporarily strip legal protections for over 500,000 migrants from Nicaragua, Cuba, Haiti, and Venezuela who were given cover under Biden-era regulations. The decision means that litigation will continue in lower courts as the administration continues with its policy. This comes after Trump orders the Department of Homeland Security to end all, quote, categorical parole programs that grants these kinds of protections. Last week, Donald Trump commuted the federal life sentence of 74-year-old Larry Hoover, founder and former leader of Chicago's Gangster Disciple Street Gang. The commutation, which applies to Hoover's 1997 conviction on drug extortion and conspiracy charges, will not actually result in Hoover's freedom, as he still has to serve 150 to 200 years for his 1973 murder conviction in the killing of William Pookie Young, a 19-year-old drug dealer. Appearing on the Breakfast Club radio show, Hoover's son, Larry Hoover Jr., explained that the family would continue to call for his father's release, saying, quote, "I'm not saying that my father wasn't in gang leadership at one point and wasn't involved in the streets, but he's had a transformation," adding, "He was an illiterate, dyslexic child when he went to jail. He taught himself how to read. He taught himself how to become a man." Now to our first story. Breakthrough's Eugene Prier and Rania Kotlik are joined by Asal Rad, scholar of modern Middle East history and author of State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran, to discuss renewed talks between the U.S. and Iran in Rome and how Israel wants to disrupt diplomacy and drag the U.S. into another war in order to stave off peace.
Asal, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you here with us. I guess here's my first question is, where do you think things stand? I mean, how realistic does it seem? It seems like the two parties are pretty far apart, especially in terms of what the U.S. demands are on Iran. Does it feel like the sort of horizon of a deal that maybe about a month or two ago seemed possible is receding, or what do you think there?
I would say in many ways we're precisely where we were, which is confused, because it's not clear what the negotiations are. And that's been the problem from the U.S. side, is that you have sort of conflicting statements in what appears to be an internal difference in the Trump administration on how they want to handle Iran, which is not that surprising. I mean, having hawkish voices, it's the same thing on the Democratic side, right? Having hawkish voices on Iran is sort of a staple of U.S. foreign policy. So what if you listen to President Trump himself, it seems like he wants a deal. That's the language that he continues to be using. And that's the same signals you're getting on the Iranian side. I think, you know, the Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, really summarized the basic conflict of how you would get a deal or no deal. He tweeted something like, if it's very simple, no nuclear weapons equals a deal, no enrichment equals no deal. So this is one of the impediments that we're working on. Of course, there's going to be layers of impediments. That's the other part I think people fail to understand, is even if they reach an agreement, there are legal impediments on the American side to actually give Iran the sanctions relief that would theoretically be promised to it in a deal that would then see limitations to its nuclear program to prevent it from having a nuclear weapon. Now, a deal between the U.S. and Iran might go beyond what the original JCPOA was. It might be more limited than what the original JCPOA was. But the problem in trying to sort of predict the current situation is that there is not consistent messaging from the American side. But there is at least positive messaging, you could say, from the president himself. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, it's not a great answer because it's not an answer. But that's because we don't have the details of what they're discussing. I will say, if the Iranian side is engaging in discussions, they would not engage in discussions that would place them at zero enrichment. That was precisely what the deal breaker and the non-starter was under the Bush administration in the early 2000s. And so this is a point that's been emphasized over and over again. Now, how they resolve that issue, that's something that we can discuss more.
So what you're saying is you don't have a crystal ball. but, you know, I do want to ask you about the wrecker and all this. Not that the U.S. isn't capable of wrecking it themselves, but, you know, there is this pattern of every time there's momentum towards diplomacy with Iran, the Israelis intervene to shut it down, whether through political pressure, sabotage, sometimes outright violence. And, you know, we just saw this report from CNN, I think about a week ago now, saying that U.S. intelligence, what was a report that was actually leaked to CNN by U.S. intelligence, so that says something, but that this new U.S. intelligence suggests that Israel is preparing a possible strike on Iranian nuclear facilities without the U.S.'s permission, involvement, to basically derail the talks. So I'm curious of what you know, how you understand the Israeli element here, because it does seem like, you know, obviously there's not very much night and day whatsoever when it comes to the Israelis and Americans on Gaza, but on Iran, there does seem to be.
The Israelis are certainly play the potential role of a spoiler. I mean, there are spoilers on both sides in terms of like the hardline camps. We call them hardliners in Iran and hawks in the US. But the role of Israel specifically is obviously something important to talk about, because what's interesting is you have Israeli officials saying, even if there is a deal between the US and Iran, that Israel won't be bound by that deal. The reason I say that's interesting is because Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid than any other country in the world, historically. Israeli officials have said themselves within the defense and security sectors that without U.S. aid and assistance, they would not be able to do anything that they've been doing, all the genocide in Gaza, the wars that they're continuing in Lebanon and Syria, anywhere that they're occupying or carrying out attacks wouldn't be possible without U.S. support. And yet, the Israeli government takes a sort of staunch line as if the leverage is in the opposite direction. And that leaves a lot of questions to be asked. Why is it that Israel can undermine U.S. policies while the U.S. is providing billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars in military aid, as well as providing, I think, something close to 70% of Israel's arms imports? So there's a sort of odd asymmetry in power, and yet if you look at the language used by the two sides, you would think that the asymmetry is in favor of Israel, when in fact it's the U.S. that holds all the leverage. Now, while it's clear that the Trump administration and President Trump himself is a staunch supporter of Israel and has essentially given them, very similar to his predecessor, a green light to do whatever they want in terms of Gaza, it seems like there is a little bit of pushback in terms of an Israeli attack on Iran, because that would derail something that President Trump, by all appearances, very much wants. I mean, he uses the language of a deal maker. He wants to say that he's accomplished these foreign policy goals, and one of them is preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon through a deal. And it's interesting, if you look at the Iranian side, they've picked up on these signals, and they're starting to use that language. They're starting to reciprocate that language. So the fact that Khamenei, the Iran supreme leader, has said he doesn't have an issue with U.S. investment in Iran, or the fact that Iran's foreign minister has used the language of like $1 trillion potential, economic potential for the U.S. in case of if there is a deal. All of that points to the fact that there seems to be the idea of mutual benefit when it comes to Iran and the U.S. This, of course, is not what Israel wants at all. They never wanted to taunt between Iran and the U.S. Because Iran is their way of using Iran as an existential threat to Israel. Is its way of always arguing that Israel is on the defensive. Even when they're committing genocide, somehow Israel is always on the defensive, and pointing to Iran tends to be the way rhetorically they try to accomplish this sort of narrative. And if there's detente between the U.S. and Iran, that undermines that narrative in many ways, because Iran becomes less of a threat if you have the U.S. president saying, well, we've blocked every road to a nuclear weapon.
You know, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about this issue that you mentioned earlier of the sort of enrichment aspect of this, because the sort of civilian military uses of nuclear power is obviously a major issue in the discussions. And I think the way it's presented, you know, sort of in the Western media, is that this is always sort of a stalking horse, and that sort of there is no legitimate civilian technological reasons why Iran would want to have, you know, nuclear power. And it's all just a cover to build a weapon at some point and, you know, break out capacity and all that kind of stuff. So I just wonder how you evaluate some of that discourse.
For Iran, there's a number of reasons why enrichment is important. It's important because it has obviously energy applications when you're enriching to a certain level. For instance, the JCPOA limited Iran's enrichment to 3.67%. You need 90% enrichment for a weapon. So we're nowhere close to that when you're enriching at 3.67%. But it has the energy applications and the research applications, which it's certainly not my area of expertise, but I think everybody is aware of the fact that there are, you know, scientific, medical, other research purposes that go behind nuclear research. And so those are the civilian purposes that we're talking about. But there's a secondary reason behind it too, and that's the fact that Iran, under international law, as a signatory to the NPT, has the right to enrich. So there's a sort of question of sovereignty, where any outside power, any foreign power, can tell Iran, you're not allowed to do this because we say so, when it's outside the framework of international laws. That in the sort of psyche of the Iranian side, especially the Iranian government, is seen as surrender or a concession to a foreign power, which would be the United States. And so those are the elements that play into it. The language that's used in the West when it comes to this sort of idea of no enrichment is to create a false narrative that if Iran is enriching at all, or if any country is enriching at all, then they become a nuclear threat. When in reality, if there are international inspections on those programs, I mean, Iran is even just recently, there are reports that they are considering the idea of actually having U.S. inspectors as part of a deal. So allowing U.S. inspectors in along with international inspectors. So if you have a nuclear program with oversight and limitations, that prevents it from being a weaponized program. And that's essentially what we're trying to do. We're trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Now, the fascinating part about all this discussion and going back to Israel is that the only country in the Middle East that actually has nuclear weapons is Israel. And we never talk about that. It's not even something that the United States government will acknowledge. It's not something that the Israeli government will acknowledge. But it tells you something about the notion of threat and the language of threat. When Israel is a state that is committing genocide currently and has nuclear weapons, and yet that is never a question that is raised.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And, you know, you have also been somebody who's been covering the genocide in Gaza, the media, the abysmal media coverage that 19 months into this just stays, gets worse somehow than before. And so I'm just curious if, you know, given the reality of the region right now, which is a lot different than the last time a deal was negotiated. Iran is in a weaker position after these 19 months of genocide that have pretty much, you know, devastated a lot of the partners across the region of Iran, whether we're talking about, you know, Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah in Lebanon, the total loss of the government that was partnered with Iran in Syria. It's a much different situation now. And I'm just curious, do you think that that sort of shift in the balance of power will play into what gets agreed to or compromised on if this deal continues to go forward?
I mean, a lot of things have changed in the last 10 years. We're not dealing with the same world. We're not dealing with the same global order. We're not dealing with the same states. Everything in the landscape, not just in the region, but also in the United States, has completely changed. And so I certainly think that all of those changes will play into the way these negotiations will manifest. At the same time, Iran, the Iranian government has been very clear about its position on negotiations. They're open to negotiations. They seem to want a deal as well. That seems to be what the Trump administration wants. Will they concede entirely because they see themselves in a position of weakness? That might affect the way that they're going to negotiate, but I don't think the red lines will change on any side, really. It's the question right now is what are the actual US red lines? Because that is not clear from the language that we're hearing from different administration officials. I think very similarly to 2015, what drew Iran to the negotiating table was actually having a negotiating partner. And I think the language of this Trump administration is different than the language of the first Trump administration. There's more sort of optimism and discussion. I mean, you can hear it in the way that President Trump talks about it himself. It's not that he doesn't have a hardline position on Iran, he clearly does. But at the same time, there seems to be actual space for negotiations and less of a maximalist approach. And if that continues to be the case, then I think there is space for some kind of resolution between these two states, which are really the main parties, right? This is supposed to include Europe, but essentially the negotiation is between Iran and the United States.
Breakthrough.
Again, that was Eugene Pryor and Rania Kallek speaking with Asal Rad about Israel's response to renewed talks between the U.S. and Iran. For our next story, Eugene and Rania are joined by Rua Doss of the Palestinian Youth Movement to discuss the Anti-Genocide Pledge, a new initiative designed to capture global outrage at Israel's genocide in Gaza.
Rua, thank you so much for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you here. And for all of us, of course, who follow the Palestinian Youth Movement on social media, we probably heard a little bit about this anti-genocide pledge. But for those who maybe haven't heard, give us a sense, what is the pledge and what are the goals of getting folks to sign it?
Yeah, you know, yesterday was the 600th day of genocide in Gaza. So for over 600 days now, we have witnessed some of the most heinous crimes in modern history. Lost more than 54,000 martyrs, with estimates we know being closer to 200,000 people, and half of them being children. 50% of Gaza's infrastructure has been destroyed. 215 journalists have been murdered. It's the starvation that we are seeing, the withholding of humanitarian aid. So just all of these absolutely horrific things that we have continued to see for 19 months now. And on the 600th day of genocide, the U.S. completed the 800 plane load of bombs and ammunition to Israel. So Israel and the U.S. have inflicted a level of mass destruction that is almost unfathomable. And we, the people, the majority, the masses of the world are tired of living in a world where we open our phones and see children screaming in pain as they're being burned alive. And ultimately, like, that is what this pledge is about. The anti-genocide pledge is a promise to stand with Palestine, and not just in words, but in action. It's a promise that, despite, you know, how many lies they tell, despite how long they prolong the genocide, despite how they try to repress the grassroots movement, we're not going to forget Palestine. We have pledged to make a lifetime commitment to upturn the very system that has made this genocide possible, and upturn the very system that has allowed it to continue. And so it's a lifetime commitment to raising our voices, to protesting, and to holding governments and corporations and institutions accountable for their role in supporting the Israeli genocide, occupation, and colonization of the Palestinian people. But importantly, also, it's also a show that the masses stand with Palestine and are united under the demands which are at the center of Palestinian liberation. This pledge was launched by a coalition of Palestinian organizations and individuals in Palestine, in the Arab world, in the diaspora, all united around the key demands which are the foundation for national unity. Demands such as denouncing the genocide against the Palestinian people, denouncing the use of starvation, opposing Israel's occupation of Palestine, supporting an immediate ceasefire, affirming the right for Palestinians to return to their land, demanding an arms embargo, and of course, calls for the liberation of the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners that are being held by Israeli forces right now. And so, you know, we launched this pledge last week, and in just 1 week, 18,000 people across 118 countries have already pledged and taken social media by storm, with dozens of organizations posting about this pledge. And signatures include really prominent leaders, people like a former Palestinian political prisoner, Omar Assaf, Sanaa Daqa, who was just imprisoned today, the activist journalist and wife of the martyred political prisoner, Walid Daqa, Carlos Latouf from Brazil, Imam Omar Suleiman from the U.S., leaders from South Africa and Chile and everywhere. And so thousands from all over the world have declared that they are unequivocally in support of Palestinian liberation and in opposition to genocide and to Zionism.
I think it really is a testament to just how big of a gap there is between governments, like in the U.S. and across Europe, continuing to fund and arm this horrific Israeli genocide in Gaza and, you know, increasingly in the West Bank as well. Whereas people across the board are opposed to what Israel's doing. And I mean, this pledge is one of many ways that it's demonstrated. And I'm just curious, you know, what does that contrast reveal about the gap I just mentioned between political elites and the global public? And I'm really asking you this because I think it's worth highlighting, because it does, I think people start to feel like everything is so futile, because nothing seems to have shifted, right? Israel's still getting all these weapons and endless supply, all this support. But actually, the majority of people oppose this, and that matters.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, as you said, Western countries have refused to acknowledge the overwhelming global support to end the genocide. Mainstream media has tried to downplay and distort the truth and minimize the massive size of the global movement and silence the voices in the streets. They're trying to portray Palestine and the Palestinian movement as a fringe movement, right? To isolate us from the masses of the people. But we know the truth. We know that our movement is a people's movement, and the people have taken it upon themselves to fill the void that is left by these, like, supposed guardians of human rights, right? These government, state actors, and much of the Western world that has remained complicit or silent. And so people are taking this and taking the matters into their own hands. And there's been a visible shift that has moved from tens of thousands of people pouring into the streets into targeted work that attempts to end the flow of weapons, get aid into Gaza, and release Palestinian prisoners. So in recent months, you know, we've seen the global movement for Palestine take bolder and braver steps. For example, activists got onto the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, risking their lives to deliver life-saving humanitarian aid, only to be targeted by the Israeli drone strike. International organizations, I know y'all just had Saif on, international organizations have launched the March to Gaza, with hundreds planning to travel to Egypt and march to Rafah in a couple weeks in order to demand the flow of aid. For over 7 months, a grassroots people's embargo against Maersk, the largest shipping company in the world, has taken logistics and the logistics and weapons industry by whirlwind. And so I think all of these efforts are a reflection, right? They represent a growing popular demand that everyday people have now committed their lives to. And this is an end to the genocide, an end to the occupation, and a full rejection of Zionism and imperialism. And because we've seen all of these efforts, right, we already know that the world stands with Palestine. This pledge, the anti-genocide pledge, is how we record that. It's how we quantify it. It's a historical record of the world's mass rejection of Zionism and the mass movement that has risen up in this moment. It's a people's record. I mean, it's how we are writing our own history. And it's a tool for the masses to register their historic position against genocide and their unwavering commitment to the Palestinian people. And so really what it is, it's a tool that the Palestine, it's a tool to record that the Palestine movement is not a fringe movement. It is in fact the majority of the world.
I think that's a crucially important, we talked about my age earlier, Rania. You know, I've been working in the Palestine Solidarity Movement since 2002. And I mean, the level of which the rejection of Zionism, the solidarity with Palestine, the understanding of the issues has changed since that time it's honestly, it feels almost, you know, unimaginable how much it's grown. And I think that's the important thing I wanted to ask you about as well, Rua, because I think maybe sometimes part of the where people get confused here is like we're not dealing with sandcastles, you know. I mean, these are some of the most powerful forces on earth, the imperialist forces, their Zionist, lackeys and others who have built up. I mean, it's a massive machine. It literally controls the earth. And I think sometimes maybe we discount how important things like this pledge, like a march, like a flotilla, like a divestment campaign, like something like that sometimes can seem small in the scale of so much of just terrible things we're seeing, are actually crucially important. Important steps forward against an enemy that an opponent that I think many people felt could never be moved one inch and would control the narrative in every possible way like they have for many decades.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you brought that point up. That's such an important point. But I think that what I want to draw our attention to is the fact that Zionists have spent billions of dollars on propaganda to try to salvage what's left of their image, right? Billions to try to make up for actually what the grassroots movement has been able to accomplish despite all odds, despite all of the things that you just named, despite the media reporting lies and manufacturing consent for genocide. The anti-genocide pledge, I think, is important because it is a direct confrontation with Zionist attempts to erase the mass character of our movement. You know, a few months ago, the Israeli government allocated an additional $150 million for the foreign ministry for quote-unquote diplomacy efforts, right? In the past week alone, foreign ministry officials have given more than 130 interviews to international media. Since the beginning of this year, the ministry has held over 25 briefings and press conferences for foreign outlets, compared to just four throughout all of 2024 and none in 2023. And so the reason why I bring this up is because it's so clear that the Zionist movement is attempting to distort and discredit and defy all logic to undermine the historic and popular support for Palestine that has taken the world by storm. They have kicked their efforts into high gear because they know that what we are doing is working, and they know that the world sees Israel for what it is. And so we need to employ our own tools to counteract this and to counteract these efforts and this money that's being poured into this. And it's easy for us to do that because we know that the truth is on our side, right? And we know that people see that. And so no matter how much money they spend on these diplomacy efforts or intimidation tactics or whatever it is, every day a new celebrity is hoisting the Palestinian flag on their stage, right? We even in like in the US, we would be hard pressed to find a graduation without a single kufiya. And so to what you're saying, the tide is not just turning. It has already turned, right? So it is now our responsibility to show that and to make sure it never turns back. And the pledge is one of the tools that we use to fight Zionist propaganda because it creates this historic record that the masses are with Palestine.
Well, I thought it'd be important to tell everybody where they can find the details of this anti-genocide pledge. Perhaps they want to sign it.
Yeah. So if you go on the website, antigenocidepledge.com, people can sign the pledge. Organizations can endorse it. There are graphics that you can download and post and show the world where you stand. And I just want to take just one moment to highlight that in this moment, all of us are being presented with a choice, right? You are with genocide or you are against genocide. This moment is an ultimatum, right? It's an ultimatum for international institutions, for states, for decision-making bodies who have feigned concern for nearly 20 months while standing by or actively aiding and abetting genocide. But it's also an ultimatum for all of the people around the world. It's an ultimatum for those who have stood on the sidelines or who have bloodied their hands with the massacre of tens of thousands of Palestinian children. So on the other side, the side of the majority, the side that we stand on, we have made it clear that we are not just going to, through words, support Palestine, but through action, right? The line has been drawn for those who are going to do everything in their power to stop this genocide and those who are going to stand on the sidelines. And at this point, only one question remains, and that's, what side do you stand on? Do you stand on the side of genocide, on the side of humanity, or where? And so I encourage everyone to go onto the website. Again, that's antigenocidepledge.com, and sign the pledge if you haven't already and send it to everyone you know. And because we must, again, through tools such as the anti-genocide pledge, mark that the majority of the world stood against the first live stream genocide, that the world did not stay silent.
Breakthrough.
Again, that was Eugene and Rania, joined by Rua Das, to talk about the Anti-Genocide Pledge Initiative. We're going to take a quick break here on Breakthrough Radio, but we'll be right back. Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for 1 hour each week. I'm Sean Blackman. For our next story, Breakthrough News Editor-in-Chief Dr. Ben Becker joins Eugene Preyer and Rania Kolik to discuss the Republican budget bill, also known as the, quote, One Big Beautiful Bill, and how it aims to make the rich even richer while gutting programs used by millions of working people.
Dr. Ben Becker, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here.
So as you know, Ben, we're now in the moment, the big, beautiful bill, as Trump called it, has passed the House. There's now some discussion in the Senate, but it's basically just a discussion of like, you know, you're going to cut off one arm or the other as it concerns this, or one arm or both as it concerns the social safety net. So it seems no matter what, it's going to be pretty bad. I mean, there's a lot here, but I mean, maybe just like top line. I mean, what is really happening here? Like, what are they actually proposing to do, trying to do? What should people be worried about and perhaps pushing back on?
Well, look, if you're rich, it is definitely a one big, beautiful bill. It's like a wish list for the ultra rich. And I'm sure they've spent the last week clinking champagne glasses because they've gotten pretty much everything they ever wanted in this one bill. But it's probably the largest wealth transfer in human history from programs, policies, budgets that are set aside to help alleviate childhood hunger and poverty, food insecurity, the lack of healthcare in this country, and just giving it right back in almost equal measure to the top 1%, the top 20%, really the top 0.1% is the biggest beneficiary, and back to the corporations, making, you know, really permanent the Trump tax cuts of 2017 for corporations, but then extending another $500 billion in sort of goodies in permanent tax cuts, while the programs that many people have come to rely on just to survive, not live in large, just to survive, are going to be destroyed. And I'd say the politics of this, the reason why they feel they can get away with this is because there is very minor tax cuts for everyone. So if you're in the top, if you're in the bottom 20% of the population among the poorest, you're going to see an extra $90 in your sort of in your tax savings. If you go up to the next 20%, you're going to get, you know, like $650. And then the middle 20%, you're going to get $1,290. And so some people say, okay, I got an extra $1,000 or $1,200 over the course of a year. That's an extra $100 a month. Thanks, Trump. You know, like that's the thing that they're banking on. But of course, if you were reliant on any federal programs, or if the cost of healthcare is going to be soaring and there's no longer any subsidies for that, or many other ways in which this negatively impacts the economy of working class people, it starts to resemble really a three-card Monte or a shell game, where you know how those games work when you're, you know, walking down the street and there's somebody who has the three cards, or they're hiding the ball under one and they make you feel like you can win some money. And so, you know, usually they'll have one person set up there to win a little money at the beginning. So you feel like, oh, I can win 20 bucks. And maybe actually they let you win 20, but the whole thing is to draw you in so that you end up spending much more money. And that's really what this is, a very elaborate shell game that's being played, where, okay, some people will see some tiny little savings, tipped workers will see no tax on tips potentially if this goes through. But again, if you're not raising the minimum wage for tipped workers, or if tipped workers are also losing their Medicaid because they're already so low wage and they have to pay out of pocket for all of their healthcare expenses, it's a net loss. It's a net gain for the corporations. But you feel for a moment like you have a little extra money in your pocket before the con man rips you off.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just broke a lot of hearts by exposing that the game is rigged, the game with the ball underneath one of the three things. But anyway,
there's often like a pickpocket hand waiting behind you too. So while you're distracted, they can like rob.
It's like Oliver Twist.
It's a great way to put it though, because it's such a scam. But of course, this bill doesn't just attack the poor in the many ways you just described, and that's just a handful of ways. I mean, these are really programs that people use to like serve for basic survival. But it doesn't just attack poor working class Americans. It also ramps up funding for mass deportations and expands the entire Trump anti-immigration agenda. So I'm curious if you could maybe go over some of the ways that they're tying this to immigration enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is not really an austerity bill per se. You know, this is nor it's going to increase the budget deficit. It's going to spend a lot of money. They're spending a huge amount of money. It's just they're not spending it on the needs of poor and working class people or the middle class even either. What they're doing is spending the money on an extra $150 billion to the military. And as you said, tens of thousands of more officers for Border Patrol and Homeland Security, the largest ever budget for those two. So basically the whole government is being reduced to, you know, uniformed men with guns. And it's either going to be the military or the Border Patrol and prisons, and then all the auxiliary subcontractors that live off of those elements of the state. So it's not like it's not small government. It's just big government for those things and small government for everyone else. And of course, you know, it's true that Trump ran on, you know, a very harsh anti-immigration policy and got a lot of the population riled up on that basis, including people who have almost no immigrants in their communities, and you know, people who just sort of were given a scare campaign about the gangs coming in. And so that's sort of what was an element of how he was elected. But he didn't run on cutting Social Security. The fact that 25% of seniors in the rural states of this country, there's 31 sort of established states that are more rural, and in those 31 states, 25% of seniors will now have to drive an extra hour to go to the Social Security offices to make any changes to their accounts. Why? Because DOGE has eliminated over-the-phone service. That's not efficiency. That's making the government intentionally deficient. It's become a department of government deficiency. And that's really what the plan of this budget bill is, too, is basically, even if they're not going to cut benefits directly, they just want to cut all of the people who deliver the benefits. So those government workers are being cut and slashed like crazy while the immigration and border patrol is going up. So, you know, for those elderly folks who might have voted for Trump, or even if they didn't vote for Trump, you know, they didn't vote for that. They didn't vote for their Social Security checks to be, you know, harder to get, or that they now have to drive an extra hour. And it's not like elderly people, it's much easier to drive long distances. You know, they're talking about a population that has a large numbers of disabilities and so forth. So basically everything about this is tilting in the direction of helping war, the deportation machine, and corporations. For everyone else, they're pretty much getting screwed. And again, in those rural areas, if you're cutting Medicaid, you're cutting Affordable Care Act subsidies, a lot of these rural health clinics, you know, they rely entirely on those programs. So it's not just you're not just actually cutting individuals from being able to access health coverage and therefore health care. You're actually going to collapse the health providing institutions themselves. The clinics and hospitals that rely on those programs will no longer be able to stay open. And so therefore everyone will suffer, even those who are not on those programs. So, you know, I think we're living in an extremely dark time in terms of inequality. You have AI threatening tens of millions of jobs. And that's the same time they're saying you're gonna have to work if you wanna qualify for Medicaid. So the number of jobs is gonna go down, but then the regulations on the working class are going to go up, requiring them to work to be able to access a program, which they know they're not going to be able to do. So this is a de facto cut to those programs, even if they're pretending that it's not.
You know, I think you're making a number of great points, and obviously this is just a travesty. And, you know, Elon Musk, by the way, behind DOGE, who's now leaving the government, saying they're not cutting enough social programs. But it feels like it also just raises another issue here, too, is it feels like such an indictment of capitalism that, you know, we're even in a situation where you've got trillions of dollars of GDP being produced. Like, it's not like there's, like, any lack of abundance of wealth and goods in the country. And we're talking about cutting already insufficient social programs. Like, that just feels like there's a deeper piece to that.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like Bernie Sanders, you know, for all the critiques of him, he made a lot of very compelling points, obvious points. The only industrially advanced country in the world that doesn't provide healthcare as a universal right. The fact that we have millions of children living in poverty, that is a policy choice right now. You know, under COVID, under Trump, actually, Trump signed these bills into law. Childhood poverty went down and childhood hunger went down by historic amounts because of the COVID era programs. There was like a 16% drop in the poverty rate in this country just because they decided to create some more programs to make sure that people couldn't be evicted. There would be extensions for unemployment insurance, for SNAP, you know, a whole range of different things. And then under Biden, and the Republicans, of course, pushed this too, they eliminated all of those programs. So you had the poverty rate just bounce right back up. Childhood hunger just bounced right back up to where it was before. It showed in clear and unmistakable terms that it was a policy choice that those millions of children would be hungry. Mm. And now
I'm going to have to end that program there. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of a speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And that wraps it up here on where we're at. But please do keep listening here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And of course, stream us online at weft.org and the WEFT app in the Google Play Store or Apple Store. But this is the Beach Boys. We'll play out Kokomo, but please do keep listening here on WEFT Champaign. Having little issues, so I'll just keep talking to you until I get the situation. I believe Radio Theater is up after this, but here's Kokomo, Beach Boys. Keep listening here on WEFT.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys. There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you wanna go to get away from it. Bodies in the sand, tropical drink melting in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of a steel drum band. Down in Kokomo,
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you to Bermuda, Bahama. Come on, pretty mama, Key Largo, Montego, baby. By and by we'll defy a little.